We are now in the latter part of chapter 3. We ended with verse 10 the last time, so we'll pick up at verse 11 tonight. And remember, the book of Ruth is such a tremendous book of love and redemption. It's what it's all about. And so tonight we're going to be looking at that redemption portion of this love story in greater detail. And there's a lot of stuff here that are typical of Jesus Christ and the church. And we'll try to bring some of that out as we move forward. But if you recall, and I studied the last time, Ruth had gone into the threshing floor where they had finished the harvest, and they took all of their bundles of wheat that they had accumulated in the gleaning of the fields and the harvesting of the fields. They bundled those up, and then they had to wait their turn in the threshing floor outside of the city of Bethlehem. It was used by more than one individual most of the time, and it's pretty apparent that Boaz is not the owner of this threshing floor. He apparently had a night that he could spend with his team of employees, and they would thresh their barley, wheat, and then store it in bags, and then the next farmer would come along and use the same threshing floor for their produce. And that's a lot of the communities, especially small ones like Bethlehem, would have shared property like that for that purpose. But they were at the threshing floor, and Naomi knew that the appointed night that he would be there, and so she made that arrangement with Ruth to go there secretly at night and to watch where he laid down to go to sleep. And then she was told that what she needed to do then was to go to him and basically make a proposal. That's the way that it was done by her. And Naomi knew exactly how to approach that and gave her all the details, which we looked at the last time. So Ruth did do that exactly as she was told, and she laid down at his feet after he had finished everything and laid down himself to go to bed. And it was around midnight, we're told, that he was startled because he didn't know what was going on. Something was at his feet, and it wasn't something that was there before he went to bed. But it turns out that that was Ruth. And in the dark, he couldn't exactly tell who it was. So, who are you? And she said, I'm Ruth. And she said, your maidservant, take your maidservant under your wing, for you are my close relative. And that word for close relative is a Hebrew word, goel, and it means kinsman redeemer. We've talked about that over the course of the last few weeks of study in this book. But he is there for that purpose. She is there for that purpose, to make that proposal to him, to let him know that she is interested in having him fulfill that which is obligatory for the relatives of Naomi, to provide one of their relatives as a goel or kinsman redeemer. To normally it would be to marry Ruth, to marry Naomi rather, and then have a child by her. But Naomi was rather elderly at this point, apparently, and it was Ruth that was next in line to Naomi, and because she was the daughter-in-law of Naomi and had lost her husband also, the kinsman redeemer could use Ruth as the one that he would take and redeem to keep the land in the ownership of the males of the family. Remember, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, had died, and Mahlon, Ruth's husband, had died, and they were both widows, and now Ruth is making this request to Boaz to fulfill his obligation as the goel. And he agrees to it. Remember, we saw that in verse 10. He says to her, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether rich or poor. Boaz is very pleased at this prospect of becoming her goel. I think he was hoping that that might happen. I know that Ruth was hoping that it would happen. And as it turned out, Boaz certainly is very much interested. He commends her for not going after the younger men, which implies that he is a lot older than she is, but yet he still is a man who is able to redeem the land and also to redeem the family through marrying Ruth. And that's exactly what is being done here, as they have made this approach to each other, and Ruth has now made the request, Boaz has accepted it, and in verse 11 now we pick up the story where it says, "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman." Proverbs 31, who can know a virtuous woman? Is asked in that particular proverb, and it's a wonderful proverb that speaks of a woman who does so much for her household that she blesses her husband and her children, and they call her blessed, and they recognize her as a virtuous woman. Great proverb to read through and to recognize, if you can, I hope you can, the qualities that are listed there, men, for your wives. And I wouldn't hesitate to repeat those qualities to your wife from time to time. It does help quite a lot. Verse, again, 12 says, "Now, it is true that I am a close relative. I am a Goel. However, there is a relative closer than I." Now, that puts a little bit of a twist in the story. And that's one of the things that makes it most interesting. Because any good story has twists and turns that you're not expecting. And this happens to be one of the best. Yes, Boaz wants to fulfill that request. However, he's aware, although Ruth and apparently Naomi wasn't even aware, that there is a relative who was closer to him. Now, we're not told what their relationship was with Elimelech. Probably cousin, uncle, kind of second tier relationships. However, no other relatives were closer than Boaz and this other relative. And you're going to find that this other relative isn't mentioned by name. And I think that that's something that the Holy Spirit did on purpose, because what we're going to find is that Boaz will indeed become the husband of Ruth, because the other relative ultimately will not be willing to pay the cost. And we'll see that in a few moments, and we'll discuss some of the reasons why that might be so. Well, it is true, he says, I am a close relative, but there's a relative closer than I. And in verse 13 he says, "Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform the duty for you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning." So what he's saying is, I can't commit myself to that because this other relative is closer, and he has to make the decision first whether he will redeem you or whether he will let you come to me as your kinsman redeemer. Notice that he says, "I'll do it for you as the Lord lives." He's making a covenantal arrangement here. He is swearing by the Lord's name that he will do it. So he's very, very much in this whole situation and wants desperately, I believe, to let it come down to his being able to do exactly that. But he's a gentleman, and he's obedient to the law of God, which states that the closest of relatives must be the one who first has that opportunity to become the redeemer. It must have hurt Boaz terribly to have to admit that that is so. And he had no guarantee what would happen. But here he's trusting the Lord. He wants to be her kinsman redeemer. There's no question of that. He tells her to lay there in the morning to protect her, by the way. It's nothing at all wrong with this arrangement. He's making sure that she doesn't have to go all the way back to Naomi's home in the dark night with the possibility of being caught by people outside of the city and doing her harm. Walking alone as a woman in the dark of night was not a good thing in that day. So he's protecting her again, as he had done earlier. And in the morning, it tells us this, in verse 14, she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. And then he said, obviously to his servants, do not let it be known that the woman came to me to the threshing floor. Also he said to Ruth, bring the shawl that is on you and hold it. So she had a shawl over her head, as was the custom of the day for the women in that area. And she was told, take it off, and so she did, and bring it to you, to me, he said, and hold it so that I can put into it 6 measures of barley. It says she held it out and he measured 6. My Bible says ephahs of barley and laid it on her, and then she went into the city. Now the word ephah is inserted by the translators in this particular version that I'm using. It's probably not an ephah. Remember, an ephah was around 30 or more pounds, and that would mean that if it was an ephah and he put 6 measures of, or 6 ephahs on her head to carry home, that would have been quite a load of 180 pounds or whatever that number would be. So it's just measures. It's not really certain what the measure was, but it was a beautiful indicator that Boaz would be completely on board with this decision that has been made in this night. He's going to send her with that 6 measures of barley back to Naomi, and Naomi is going to know from that Boaz has agreed. If he had done nothing, there would have been a question, I believe, in Naomi's mind. But I'm certain that when she saw all of that which had been done and saw all of the grain that she brought with her back from Boaz, she knew it was a done deal, that Boaz would not rest until it was completed. So it tells us that in verse 16, when she came to her mother-in-law, Naomi said, is that you, my daughter? And then she told her all that the man had done for her. It's interesting that in the original Hebrew, the phrase, is that you, is just made up of 2 words. Who? You. It's like a question is being asked, and in the Hebrew idiomatic expression, who are you, there is apparently a way of understanding that question without really thinking that the person asking the question doesn't know who it actually is, because she identifies her immediately in that very same phrase. So literally, in other words, she says, who are you, my daughter-in-law? The idiomatic expression basically leans toward the idea that she's not asking who are you, but how did it go? And that's why the New King James Version that I'm using translated it, is that you? And in some translations, it is a question, how did things go? And both are correct. So she told her everything that the man had done. And in verse 17, she said, these 6 ephahs, of course, measures of barley, he gave me. For he said to me, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So he's telling Ruth, your mother-in-law is going to assume from this gift correctly about my decision. Verse 18 says, then she said, sit still, my daughter, Naomi speaking, until you know how the matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. Boaz is a type or picture of Jesus Christ. Ruth is a type or picture of the church. And that's why we talk about the redemption story in this wonderful story of Ruth, because it is a very, very wonderful metaphor, an allegory that shows us the relationship that Christ has with his church. And that's a beautiful presentation here, that he will not enter his rest until he has concluded the matter. And I'm reminded in our study in Zephaniah just a few weeks ago, we looked at the last verses of chapter 4 of that prophetic book. And do you remember, it was a song that the Lord is giving to Zephaniah. And it is a song that says that the Lord is filled with joy and will rest in his love. Future tense, he will rest in his love. When will that be? When the conversion of souls is complete and the people of God have been brought into the kingdom. And then he will rest in his love. Not until then. Of course, it can be said that Jesus is seated at the right hand of the Father, and in that sense, he's resting. But in that higher sense of the word, it will be complete when the church is home with him. And so, for this author to write in this passage that Boaz will not rest until he has concluded the matter, it's a really good picture of that rest which is being looked forward to by our Lord Jesus in that day when we're gathered to be home with him in the glory. Rest in his love, and he is indeed going to do that. Boaz now is making preparation. Now that Ruth has gone back to Naomi and she's reported these wonderful news items to her mother-in-law, that Boaz now has to get to work, and he's not going to delay. He's going to go and prepare the way. Just as Jesus told his disciples, "I go to prepare a place for you." Boaz has work to do, and he's going to do it rather quickly. Verse 1 of chapter 4 tells us, "Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there. And behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, 'Come aside, friend, sit down here.' So he came aside and sat down." Now it's interesting to note that at the gate of the city of Jerusalem, of Bethlehem, and at the gate of any city was where the elders would gather to discuss civil matters. And they were the judges of the community, and they gathered together at the entrance of the city that was called the gate. They would have seats that they would sit in, and they would discuss those events, and they would make decisions that needed to be made on behalf of the people who came to the gate for that very purpose. Also take note of the fact that Boaz knows the name of the individual, but again, in the text that we have, the man's name is not given. And so the translation in my version, the New King James, in verse 1 says, "Come aside, friend, and sit down." And a lot of your translations also may have a similar statement, but it's a Poloni Almoni, literally so-and-so is the name that is given. Come aside, so-and-so. So the implication from that phrase is that the writer does not choose to reveal the name. It's not that Boaz didn't know his name, but the writer chose not to reveal it. And I believe that's by the Spirit of God that that was done. Because the man's name is being protected by the Lord here, I believe, because he is given an opportunity that he's not going to ultimately decide to accept. But it's interesting how that all plays out. And as we move forward, we'll see that as it is given to us. Verse 2 tells us Boaz went through the process of gathering together 10 men of the elders of the city. And he told them, "Sit down here." And so they sat down. Then he said to the close relative, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belonged to our brother Elimelech." I want to stop there, and there's another question in terms of the way this particular phrase is translated. In my translation, it is translated in the past tense, sold, as in has already been accomplished. That is exactly as it was written in the Hebrew original. However, it's better translated, is selling, rather than sold. And I'll explain that as we get further down. Because Naomi did not yet sell the property. And it's obvious that that's the case as we read verse 5, which we'll get to momentarily. Unfortunately, because it was translated correctly in the New King James, they overlooked the fact that the property actually still belonged to Naomi in subsequent verses. So it's difficult, and it's confusing perhaps, but it's correct, literally, if not translated correctly. So again, verse 3, going to reread it. Then he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back. Then he said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sells the piece of land which belongs to our brother Elimelech. And the word belongs is in italics, which means it is not in the original language. So basically is, which is our brother Elimelech's property. Verse 4 says, and I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants of my people. And again, that phrase is inserted by the New King James translators because they assume that it was sold, and he's saying, buy it back from the one who bought it from Naomi. That did not transact at all in that way. And we'll see that in a moment. So it basically should have said, buy it in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And so he said, I will redeem it. Sounds great. The reason he would be willing to do that? Simple. It was a very inexpensive piece of land for him to buy. It increases his inheritance for his family. Larger property, more produce, helps him financially. It's a win-win situation for him. That's a great deal. I'm willing to buy the land. And that was basically what was required of the kinsman redeemer. It's spelled out for us very, very clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 25. I'm not going to go there, but it might help you if you want to go back to that and to read there what it says about the kinsman redeemer and his responsibilities to the one who has lost her husband. So he's agreeing, I'll do it. And I wonder if, again, Boaz's heart must have sunk. He was hoping that his answer would be no, I'm certain. But Boaz also has something else that he needs to share with this person that is the closer relative. And it must be that he doesn't realize that, otherwise he might not have been so apt to say as quickly as he did that he would redeem the land. That's only part of what he has to do as kinsman redeemer, and it's relayed now to him in the following verses. Verse 5 it says, then Boaz said, on the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, and that is correct, it is from Naomi, not from the one who bought the land from Naomi, but directly from Naomi. She is the seller, and he would be the buyer. On that day, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. Remember, we talked about that levirate vow that they must make as kinsman redeemer, that they would take the widow and bear a child by the widow of that man who had died, and thereby give the son that would be born of that interaction with the wife of the dead man. That son then belongs to the family of the deceased, not the goel, and as a result, the inheritance is passed on to that individual instead of to the goel and his family. That was what caused the problem for the other man. And it tells us, and the close relative said, verse 6, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. You redeem my right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. So he's saying, all right, I'm willing to get the land, but I'm not willing to take the wife. It's interesting. If we are following along with the similarities between Christ and his church and that relationship between Boaz and Ruth, recognize, if you will, what is taking place here. And think of it this way. If Boaz represents Christ, then this other goel, this other one that could have redeemed the land, is like the law. And yes, the law is good as far as the land is concerned with regard to the nation of Israel. The law was that which was given to the nation of Israel. Israel is a one nation that has occupied the land and still does today. So the law could not redeem the church. Only the Redeemer, only Christ could redeem the church. The other Goel could not redeem Ruth, just like the law cannot redeem the church. It's an interesting analogy, I think. I hope you see what I'm trying to say in all of that. See, the law has limitations, but Jesus, as the Goel of the church, the kinsman redeemer, had no limitations. And he was absolutely willing and able to redeem the church. You remember in the book of Revelation, in chapter 4 of the book of Revelation, John is caught up into heaven, and he sees this glorious scene where all the elders are standing around the throne of God, and there's a scroll in the Lord's hands. And the question is asked, who is worthy to open the scroll and to look at the contents, basically? No one in heaven, no man in heaven or on earth or under the earth was available, was able. There was only one who was able. And that one, John sees as the Lion of Judah, and he looks at him and sees him as the Lamb of God that was slain from the foundation of the world, Jesus Christ. He is the only one able to open the scroll and read its contents. He is the only one to redeem the people of God and buy back, basically, the land that was usurped from him who rightfully owned it. And that is Satan. It's a title deed to the earth. Remember when Satan deceived Eve and Adam sinned? So Satan became the god of this age. And he ruled over the world and does rule over the world until that day that that scroll is taken by the Lamb of God and the seals are broken. And Jesus, our Redeemer, is the only one who was ever able and is the only one who will be able to take that scroll. And ultimately that will be done very, very soon, I believe, when he comes for the church and we are set free from these bodies and glorified as his body is glorified, and we will be like him and we will live forever with him in glory. What a wonderful picture that is. And this agreement now that is being made between Boaz and his closer relative is a symbol of, a demonstration of that very fact, that Boaz is the one and only one who could redeem Ruth, because Jesus is the only one who could redeem the church. The close relative said, I cannot redeem it for myself. It's interesting that also part of that levirate arrangement, which was defined for us in Deuteronomy 25, actually goes back much further than that, all the way back to the book of Genesis. We see an example of that given to us in the life of Judah, one of the sons of Israel, or Jacob. All the way back in Genesis 38, we see the story of Judah. He had three sons, and his oldest son married a woman named Tamar. His oldest son died, and it was the obligation of Judah then to give his next son to Tamar to carry on his oldest son's relationship, bear a child, and then become the inheritor of the oldest son's property. Well, the second son didn't want to do that. Married her, but refused to have relations with her. And as a result of that, God took him. God was very offended by the fact that he would not perform the responsibility of the Goel. Well, the third son was rather young. And Judah decided, well, I'll give him to you, but he's too young yet. You'll just have to wait for him, Tamar. So he told Tamar to go back to her home, and when the time was right, he would give her the third son. However, he was very reluctant to do that. In fact, he did not want to do that and would not have done that. So Tamar took it upon herself when she realized that it wasn't going to happen. She decided that because she apparently knew Judah pretty well, she dressed herself up as a harlot and stood at the corner of the city where she lived, knowing that Judah would be coming by, and when he did, he saw her, didn't know that it was Tamar, thought it was one of the community's prostitutes, and he was intrigued by her, and he made her an offer. I'll give you a sheep if you let me come into you. That was quite a prize for her, if she was truly a prostitute. But she did something very, very wise in that transaction. She said, how will I know that you'll give me a sheep for this? He said, well, I'll give you my staff and my ring as a proof. So here, take that. And she agreed. The result of that was that she became pregnant. And several weeks afterward, Judah was told by his servants, Tamar is pregnant. And he was so angry, he insisted that she be brought to him. And he was going to have her stoned for her infidelity. But before he could say anything, she took his ring and his staff, and she said, I have this child in me by the hand of the man who owns these. Judah couldn't do anything about it. He got caught in his own trap. And so he married Tamar, and she bore Perez. Now Perez is going to come into this story at the end of chapter 4, so we'll get to that point in a few moments. But anyway, that was the levirate arrangement even in Judah's day. And all the way up till 400 years later, it's still in effect in Boaz's day. So there's a procedure that Deuteronomy 25 tells us about that needs to be done when the goel refuses to accept his responsibility. And it's basically this. If he said no, then the woman who was a widow would take off one of his sandals and spit in his face. And then he'd be known as the man who lost his shoe. It would be an insult, a stain on his reputation, if you will. Well, things had changed a little bit by the time Boaz came along, but not by much. It tells us in verse 7, now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging to confirm anything. One man took off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was a confirmation in Israel. So the other goel would take off his sandal. He's the one that did not want to do this. He's taking off his sandal to indicate that he would not want to walk on that property that he refused to buy. Typical in that day. Verse 8 says, therefore the close relative said to Boaz, buy it for yourself. So he took off his sandal. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day and that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. He must have been so very happy. And I'm convinced that Jesus rejoices at the salvation of everyone who comes to faith through him. I'm reminded of one of the parables that Jesus spoke of, given to us in Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, around verses 45 and 46, it's a very short parable. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like this. There was a merchant. He was a buyer of pearls. And he wanted to buy a very, very fine pearl, a pearl of great price. So what he did was he bought the land on which the pearl was hid. That's the goel. And he's talking about himself. There are some who mistranslate that as the church being the merchant and the pearl being our salvation. That's really not what it's talking about. It's talking about Jesus as the merchant, and the pearl is the church. And again, this is a wonderful picture that is given to us here in this story. Boaz has bought the land knowing that the pearl, which is what he really, really wants, is so precious to him. And in order for him to get that pearl, he must buy first the land. And that's exactly what the parable in Matthew 13 is all about. And again, it's a great picture of Jesus Christ buying that land to get that pearl of great price. Verse 10 says, "Moreover," again, Boaz is still speaking, "Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day." So it's a special meeting. The elders are there. He's made this statement. Now the judgment must be made by the elders that they agree with this transaction. Verse 11 says, "And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, 'We are witnesses.'" They, yes, agreed. And then they give this wonderful blessing on behalf of Ruth. It tells us, "Yes, we are witnesses. Now the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built the house of Israel, and may you prosper in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman." He's blessing Boaz, or they are, but they're also blessing Ruth. They're also giving Ruth this wonderful expression of their expectation that she is going to bear him children. And like the wonderful women that married Israel, Jacob, Leah and Rachel, they were the mothers of most of the sons of Israel, not all of them. There were two concubines as well that bore four of the sons of Israel. However, the two who were married to Israel are mentioned here. But nonetheless, the statement that they're making is, "Boaz, we know that this is a good arrangement for you, and we pray that the Lord will bless you as he did Israel through his wives, Rachel and Leah. And the woman that you are marrying, may she be the one who provides you with all of this great blessing." So again, Boaz and Ruth are both blessed here by the people. Verse 13 continues and says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, 'Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a close relative, and may his name be famous in Israel. And may he be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons, has borne him.'" Naomi here is blessed by the women of the community. So great blessings are being poured out from the people of God to Boaz, to Ruth, and to Naomi. And it can be said, too, that Naomi represents the nation of Israel, that she could not bring forth the offspring, but Ruth would do that. And in doing that, then the flock would be complete. And what a blessing it is that Ruth was able to do exactly what all of them had expected. And it tells us at the end of this great short book, I wish it were longer, but it tells us in verse 16, "Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. Also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, 'There is a son born to Naomi.'" Take note, it was the neighbors who gave the name Boaz. He called his name, the name of the child rather, Boaz's son. And the name of the child is Obed. And he is the father of Jesse, and Jesse is the father of David. So here we have a connection. Boaz was a descendant of Perez. And Perez, remember, was the son born of the relationship between Judah and Tamar. All of those many years have passed, and the generation after generation, following along from one generation to the next, the plan of God is being worked out beautifully, masterfully, by the Lord, until it is time for this story to develop, to show us this wonderful story of redemption, this wonderful story of love that God has for his people in a special way that has given so much depth of meaning to us as we now look to Jesus, our Goel, our kinsman redeemer. None other than he could have done this. No angel, no other man, nothing could have been done by anyone other than Jesus Christ to accomplish that which he has accomplished on our behalf. What a great blessing it is to be redeemed by the great one and only kinsman redeemer. So we have a partial genealogy here given to us. Boaz begot Obed, Obed begot Jesse, Jesse begot David. And he goes further than that now at the end of this chapter, just to reiterate the importance of this genealogical record that we have. He tells us in verse 18, now this is the genealogy of Perez. Perez begot Hezron, Hezron begot Ram, and Ram begot Amminadab. Amminadab begot Nahshon, and Nahshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz, and Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. And David was the father of those who descended from him, who ultimately resulted in Mary and Joseph having a son. Matthew's gospel gives us the record of the lineage of Jesus Christ. So does Luke, but from two different perspectives. And if you've not remembered exactly how that has worked out, you can study the both of them and realize that the one gives us the lineage all the way from Adam to Joseph, through David, through Solomon, to Joseph. And it's interesting to note that Joseph was not the father of Jesus, but because he was the adoptive father of Jesus, Jesus inherited through Joseph that which was the kingly right, the legitimate right to the throne, through Joseph, passed on to Jesus, although he wasn't the father of Jesus, because he married Mary, and Mary had Jesus as her son. Jesus then became the inheritor of that which was passed on through Joseph. The other lineage gives us a lineage through a different son to Mary. And then Mary then gives us the blood right. The two were necessary. And without one or the other, Jesus could not have been the kinsman redeemer. But he came at just the right time to just the right couple in just the right way that God had already prescribed from the very foundations of the world that it would happen exactly as it did. And this story is just a piece of that puzzle as it goes through the Old Testament into the New Testament. And we see so wonderfully the fulfillment of everything that God had promised through this lineage that is given to us here. This is a remarkable thread in the story of redemption. And that's why I consider this book one of the greatest Old Testament books. They all are very wonderful. But this one stands, I believe, in a very, very special place to me. I hope it does to you too. So until the next time, we'll be back with you next week, probably in the book of Psalms, My intention is to select some of the Psalms from time to time through the next several weeks to take a look at various aspects of the Psalms of not only David, but others who wrote many of the Psalms, like Asaph or the sons of Korah. But they're very, very special to me, and I hope they will be to you. So we'll begin our study in the book of Psalms the next time. Until then, grace and peace. God bless.